This is the continuation of session 4.
Okay, now the third principle. What was the third principle again?
Nothing
but the Dharma can help you. Okay, so now I'll write up those three. I'm not going to do this in Tibetan because we don't have time. So those of you who grade, have mercy on this question, okay? All right. For those of you who can't see, number one, the first argument for proving that nothing but the Dharma can help you is that friends and relatives can't come with you, okay, when you die. Friends and relatives cannot come with you. And the image in the Lam Rim is of a guy dying on his deathbed, and the relatives actually holding onto your arms and begging you not to go. And you go. You see what I mean? And I think one of the parts you should do here is just to think of how alone you will feel. You see, like, all throughout your life, especially if you have a family or 20 students who follow you around everywhere, you're never alone. You see, you're never truly alone. But on that day, totally alone. You see, one thing about bardo beings, one feature of a bardo being is that you're totally, completely alone. You know what I mean? You're really on your own. Two seconds after the breath stops, you are on your own. You know what I mean? And that's one of the features of dying. Okay? So it doesn't matter, you know, don't put your hopes, too much hopes in friends, relatives like that. Okay? And you will be forgotten. Okay? I mean, you want to think that your loved ones will remember you, but not really. You know what I mean? If it takes a year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, they'll forget you. You know what I mean? You will be like a very dim memory. My mother was extremely dear to me and my closest friend. And I can hardly remember her face or, you know what I mean? It's been some time and it goes. Even the people that you think love you the most, life will go on here in the desire realm, in this sector of the desire realm. And you will be forgotten and you will be alone. And you can't, you know, if you're a good death meditator, you have to give up putting much hope in those things. You know, and your paths will not cross much after that. Karmically, you will bump into them from realm to realm, but not much. And you'll have new parents and new children and new, you know, it's all very fragile and very fleeting, and it will just be gone. And then main thing is you're alone. You can't count on those things. You can't hope for those things. People ask me, I mean, people still want to know, can I take someone with, you know, what will happen to my relatives? You know, will I meet my mother again in my next life or something like that? I mean, if you practice Tantra, okay, you can have your cake and eat it too, all right? The idea being that Mr. and Mrs. Chakrasambhara thing, you know what I mean? You can be with them forever if you both get enlightened around the same time. Seriously. So go for that. But otherwise, it's going to be a brief meeting here, and then you definitely won't remember them a few minutes after you die. You know, maybe a day or a couple days, and then it's over. You know, and you won't remember who you were with. The people ask me why you can't remember your past lives. Death consciousness, the consciousness you will have in the bardo, is very similar to your dream consciousness. Now, you see what I mean? The shift in consciousness between 7 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning is about the same as between now and death. You see what I mean? So as much as you relate to your family in your deepest dreams, which is, you know, maybe you might think of your friends or brother or something in your dream, and then it's gone or something like that, that's how much you will remember when you die. You know, the consciousness is, the level of consciousness is very, very similar, okay? And you got to realize that. You have to think about that. So, you know, how much during your dream period, and they divide in the tantras between deep dream and light dream periods, but in either case, the amount that you remember about your life and your loved ones and your activities and your job and everything else, the amount that you are actually, you know, lucid about your bank account and, you know, I mean, the details of your life will be very similar, is very similar to the amount of consciousness and memory you can take with you after you die. You won't remember. What I'm trying to say is you won't remember this life much more than you remember it in a deep dream, because the level of consciousness is almost exactly the same. You will have, and then you won't remember it. I mean, 49 days later, you're reborn. 5 years later, you're able to talk. And you know, if you've been in a dream for 5 years and 49 days, deep sleep, how much will you remember about the what was going on at the conscious level 5 years and 49 days ago? You see what I mean? Even a few days after you die, it's all a blur, you know? So realize that. You can't take refuge in those things. It won't help you, okay? They cannot contact you. And you will not remember them, and you'll pass on. Supposedly everybody in this room has been that thing to you also many times, and you don't remember anything about it, okay? And you won't remember 10 minutes, 20 minutes after you die. You won't remember much, okay? Yeah?
So how does that explain people having visions of past lives maybe
years ago? There is a thing in, if you do deep meditation, if you reach like a certain state of shamatha, and definitely, well, I should say, after you've seen emptiness directly, right after that, you can have a direct perception of, for example, your future lives, okay? And in deep states of meditation, you can remember some things about your past life. But the fact that it's so rare, how many people have you met in this life who claim to have a memory from their past life that you trusted, that you believed them? So, I mean, how many, you know, there have been books written about the 700 confirmed incidents out of 5 billion people. You know, and, you know, it happens, but it's extremely rare, okay? In a dream, it's possible you can think of the exact amount of your bank account, but unlikely, okay? The point is that you can't hope for those things. You cannot take them with you. You will be alone, and they will be forgotten within, what, a day, 5 days? You know, you move on by yourself, okay? Number two. the text actually says that. Okay, the English says here, cannot take a molecule of your stuff with you. Okay. Not a duten means molecule. Atom bomb in Tibetan is duten boom. Okay. Okay. Alright, so, and this is kinda also depressing. I mean, you work your whole life. I mean, the reason you get up in the morning, the reason you move the leg off the bed. We were talking about New York the other night. There's two kinds of people. One kind gets up in the morning and puts the foot off the bed and touches the ground. When that foot touches the ground, it's because you want something. You see what I mean? Made noble, ignoble, whatever. That foot touches the ground because you want something. And then there's these totally depressed people who just stay in bed all day. And really, and you know them. Maybe you've been one, you know. Or you've had days when you were definitely like that. And the foot doesn't touch the ground because they really don't want anything because they see everything is they feel everything is useless. There's no meaning, you know, and they don't put the foot off the bed to touch the ground, you know. When you hit the ground, it's because you want something. You see what I mean? And then you run, you literally race the whole day to collect objects. You want something, you know. You're after something, and the fact that you have shoes proves you want something. You see what I mean? Because it hurts to walk that far without shoes on. Really, I'm not kidding. Okay, the fact that you have shoes proves that you want something, that you're going to be walking someplace during the day to get something. You know what I mean? And all of that stuff that you're after, you know. And we're not greedy people here. You know, you wouldn't be here if you were. You know, you're not like the people who are obsessed with wealth or got to have a Lamborghini car, whatever they call it, or you know, got to have this kind of clothes or this kind of clothes. I don't think there's people in here like that. But we have like a low level of that, you know, like you do have possessions and you do put a lot of hope in them. And you are definitely willing to work day after day and devote 90% of your quality time to earning little green rectangles of paper so that you can exchange them for a better car or something like that. You're willing to spend at a rate of X dollars per hour your precious life for those objects. You're willing to exchange life for objects. My boss, I hate to talk bad about him, he also sponsored a lot of buildings at Sarah May. But anyway, he's Israeli. I said, why do you do that? He says, I'm covering my bases. You know? But I forgot what I was going to say. Oh. I went in one day, I said, you know, all these diamond sorters have sore eyes. You know, we get up, you're supposed to do 10, 30,000 stones a day. You know, you go through them with a pair of tweezers, there's a pile of diamonds in front of you, and you've got this thing, you know, and you're like, it's like this. you know, and you're just grabbing them with these tweezers and checking and throwing them in the right pile and grading them by color and all that. And then I said, you know, people can't see when they get out of here. How about we give free eye exams to everybody? And he says, how much would that cost? You know, and I said, you know, $X hundred. He says, forget it, you know. And then I said, well, you know, you really should because you're using up their eyes. You know, he says, they're selling me their eyes. You see, he said it right out. It came out of his mouth. He says, they are selling me their eyes. I pay them, I get their eyes, you know. They are selling me the life in their eyes. And that's the arrangement, you know. And you're doing that all day long. You're selling your body, some part of your body, for those pieces of paper. And in order to get something else. You see what I mean? And that's the way the economy works. So, and it's crazy in the light that you're going to die tonight. You can't keep any of those things. You see what I mean? You can't, of all the things you've ever earned and ever acquired, it's the irony, I think, is that 20 minutes after you die, you probably won't remember any of them at all. So, I mean, not only do you lose them, you won't even remember. By the way, the scriptures say the only thing you have left is the bad karma you collected to get them. You see what I mean? Like whatever lies you said or whatever backbiting you did or backstabbing to other employees or, you know, all you got left is the karma from the effort of collecting the things. And then the things themselves are going to go look for new owners. You know what I mean? And so forget it. You know, by the way, I am not trying to present a rationale for grubbing off other people. Okay? You do have to have yandape tsoa. Say yandape tsoa. Right livelihood. Okay? I mean, it's a Buddhist's responsibility to have a livelihood that does not grub off other people. Okay? You're not a Buddhist is not allowed to just, you know, say, oh, everything's impermanent, I'm going to grub you off, you, Worth, just send me a check, okay? And, you know, it's not right, okay? It doesn't work that way, okay? You're responsible to have your own right livelihood. Should be healthy. You have to be, feed your body well, sleep it well, rest it well, you know what I mean? And take good care of it. And it's your responsibility to have, I mean, the idea of charity in Buddhism comes down to you as a Buddhist are responsible for arranging a conducive meditation and sleeping space and study space and reasonable amount of food and other things you need for your practice, and then the rest you can give away. But you are required to arrange that for yourself. Now, you can do it from a sponsor under special conditions. You know, you can't suck up to them, you can't lead them on, you can't pretend to be someone you're not. These are all those five bodhisattva vows about wrong, and they mostly apply to people who are looking for sponsors, you know, that you have to be totally honest, totally upfront with them, and totally frank, and take what they give you and use it properly and all that, okay? But the idea that I'm trying to talk you into quitting your job and grubbing off other people is not the goal. That's a breaking vows, you know. That's actually doing a kind of violence to the people around you. You see what I mean? And that's not right. Okay? So you should be careful to pay your own way. Okay? But it don't take 50 weeks of work in the United States to pay your own way. That's a myth. You know, that's a dangerous myth. Okay? I mean, it's amazing. It's extraordinary that a culture has developed on this planet that has convinced the people who live in that culture that they should work 96% of the time to have 4% of the time. You see? That's just extraordinary. I mean, I think people will dig up our civilization and they'll dig out these work rules from the corporations and say, this is amazing, you know, and these people, they worked 50 weeks a year to get 2 weeks off, you know, and this is, you know, what were they thinking of? You know? And they went to exercise because they ate too much. And, they had more, so many things that made them sick, and then they worked 96% of the time to make sure they could have enough to make them sick. You know, and no, it's crazy. It's wild. Find a 30-hour week job. Find a 20-hour week job. Tell me you can't do it. Come on. You know what I mean? Make an honest living. Make sure you have a conducive space to practice in and to study in, but don't kill yourself for 96, you know, that doesn't make sense. You don't need that. That's some kind of compulsion or addiction. That we were out in Arizona at this new place, you know, and we didn't have electricity or, you know, these other things. We didn't have a refrigerator and stuff, and we found out within 5 days we can live without them. And then we're like wondering, who foisted this on us? You know, who convinced me that I need those things? You know what I mean? And then it's you. You know what I mean? Who talked us into having all this stuff? You know what I mean? That you don't really need. And it's amazing. You don't have to work like that. You should object, you know. You should refuse to do that, you know what I mean? And take back some of your time, okay? It takes a little bit of time to pull it off, but you should do it. Yeah.
I'm a Dharma book study. I really have a hard time passing up a book that I don't own yet in the store. And it makes me feel kind of guilty. On the other hand, I know they go out of print so fast, and I'm afraid if I don't buy it.
I think my teachers would say, that's a wonderful fetish. And, I mean, I've had friends who had that fetish, and the teachers were like, go for it, you know, fine. You know, work an extra week. That's okay. They said anything you spend for Dharma books is special. That's different. That's not what I'm talking about. Okay? That'll get you enlightened. Okay. All right, number three. Number three says, cannot take your own body. Okay, like relatives can't go with you. Cannot take a molecule of the stuff that you own. And you can't take your body. Now, it seems obvious, but if you've ever been done violence to, you know, like women getting raped or a man getting punched or something like that, someone grabbing onto your arm and holding it and refusing to let go who's stronger than you, and there's this sense of violation, you know, there's this sense that you're holy space has been violated by this other person, and there's this outrage that you feel in your heart, even when you hear about a rape or something, that someone would violate another person's body. You see what I mean? And then when you, the idea of losing a piece of your body is so repulsive to most people. You know, like I had an old Mongolian man that I used to take care of, and he had diabetes, and I would go back and give him his shots every morning, and he got gangrene in his foot, and he went to the nursing home, and they said, you have to have this cut off at the knee. And he refused. You know, he said, I would rather die. And they said, you have to or you will die. And he said, then I'll die. I don't care. And he refused. He said, I cannot go. He had this, I don't know why, but he had this belief that he had to die with a whole body. You know what I mean? This was very important to him. And that's that sense you have. You feel like the minute someone comes within 2 feet of your space in America, you're like, you know, but then when they actually violate your body space, you feel this outrage, and this anger comes up in your heart, you know. And then imagine losing the whole thing at once. You see, one big shot, one big violation of every single piece of your body, you know. Like this thing that you take so much for granted will be ripped away from you mercilessly. You see what I mean? They say that you can even watch it, you know, like you're up there for the first few minutes looking at it and thinking, this is not fair. You feel Bardo was feel lots of anger and injustice and violation. You see, they have these feelings of hatred and anger and being cheated of something that they used to own, you know, and they watch people handling their clothes and their possessions, and they get angry, and they're like screaming, and they're like banging on this space in front of them and like a window or something, and they feel very violated, you know, and that their body has been taken from them, and that also will have to go. You see what I mean? And then there's this weird thing where, especially you're attached to your faith. You know, you equate your faith with you a lot because you equate other people so much with their faces. Petra is this face, you know, that when your face is torn away. Like when you get a cut on your face or something happens to your face, especially in America, you're very careful to fix it, you know. But just think of your whole face being ripped. You see what I mean? And then your identity is broken. You see what I mean? And then you start to forget your name. You see? And within a few hours or a couple of days, you can't remember what your name was. And then the whole thing is stolen, ripped from you, and you feel this sense of violation. And the Bardawas are, those beings in the Bardo are like angry. And hateful because this thing has been done to them, and you can't take anything. You can't even remember your own name. You see what I mean? And so forget thinking that those things are going to help you. They can't. Okay? Don't put so much I think it was Socrates that said, you know, the more attachment you have to each one of those, the harder it's going to be for you when you die. You see what I mean? The prettier your face, the stronger your body. You're setting yourself up for more suffering, you know? It'd be better to be ugly and weak because the sense of anger when you die won't be so bad. But he said with each sense attraction, you are nailing your body, you're nailing your soul, even Aristotle, you're nailing your soul more to hell, you know what I mean? Because of the anger you'll have. You can't take any of those things with you, okay? Like the body, the things, and the friends, and the family, and the people around you, ultimately even your own name, and your face, your identity, and they'll be gone. And then the only thing you're stuck with is your mental continuum, chock full of all the karmas you collected in this life. You see what I mean? And that's all you get to take with you. And you can't leave any of those behind. So it's a big, it's the opposite of what you think. You know, you think it'd be some comfort to have more things, or some comfort to be healthier, or some comfort to have more friends or family. But the truth is, the pain will be more when you die. And the effort you took to get those things, which is normally involves more negative effort than positive effort, means that you will enter your next existence with more bad karma in your mind than good karma. Okay? And that's all you can take with you. You see what I mean? So what you really should be concentrating on 8 hours a day, 50 weeks a year, is making sure that the right things are in your mental continuum. You see? Because that's the only thing you can take with you. So what we do is reversed. We spend 50 weeks a year making sure we have the outside physical things that we can't take with us, and that my physical body is pretty and healthy and all that, and at the expense of the Dharma time. You see what I mean? And it's the reverse of what a death meditator would do. Okay? If you're a really good death meditator, you'd be spending 50 weeks a year, 8 hours a day, on filling up this mental continuum with nice karmas. And then, you know, living with whatever external circumstances keep you alive, a minimum. And I don't mean just alive. I mean comfortable for practice. Okay, comfortable bed, comfortable cushion for your meditation, healthy food, nice air, you know, but not more than that. Okay, like that. Okay? Yeah. I was going to tell you the story, but I didn't want to distract from the meaning of the story. He never did. And this was, I'm sorry, he just recently did. But this was 1976 or something. And he lived in the nursing home for 20 years. And they gave him local antibiotics. And he was the first person in a long time to refuse to have an amputation when he got gangrene. And it never spread. And I visited him for 20 years. And you know, they bandaged it from time to time, and it never got worse. And they were sort of, and every time I met him, he looked at me like, "You're the guy who tried to talk me into cutting my leg off." You know? And you know, and then, look, it's fine, you know. And I felt really bad. He never got over the gangrene. I guess you can't get over. I don't know. It never went away. And then eventually, I think 2 years ago, they cut it. But you know, and he was too old to fight it or something. So, okay. Yeah.
So in the bardo, you don't see or recognize other bardo beings?
You can in the bardo. He said, can a bardo being see another bardo being? You can. And apparently they there's a lot of, in the Abhidharma, there's a lot of detail about it. You know, they travel, certain ones of them travel upside down. And yeah, and you can tell from the physical color and shape what they're going to be in their next life. And things like that, if you can remember, but you can't, you know. So, yeah.
One of my lamas one time told me that when you're saying you can't take your relatives with you or they can't come with you, but one of my lamas said once that the same person stays with you. That very lama will be with you.
You mean a lama?
Yeah.
That could travel you with you from life to life?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a whole different thing. That's absolutely true. Okay, yeah, no. No, I mean, when you say you can't take your relatives and friends with you, no, lamas for sure. They stick with you from lifetime to lifetime, for thousands and millions of lifetimes, you know. They're at your side. Whether you recognize them or not is another thing, but they stick with you, and they have the power to do that, okay? And you may not recognize them.
So when you're in the bardo, they're there too?
I would say that they're aware of you being in the bardo. They cannot enter a bardo as a bardo because they don't have any bad karma like that. You see what I mean? But they can be there in the bardo, and you may not recognize them. They can emanate into the bardo. They can. You could see them in some form in the bardo. They know for sure. Yeah, and they follow you. You know. She said, "Can a tukku go into a bardo?" Yeah. Do they experience a bardo as a bardo? No way. You see what I mean? But they can understand your experience of the bardo, and they can emanate so that you see them in the bardo, and they can do that. And that's a practice. They say in Tantra, you know, best thing is to take care of everything in this life, but if you don't, at least get enough energy that in the bardo that they can take, that you can go, that you can move into nirvana in the bardo. Okay. Yeah?
What about, so then it doesn't have to be unpleasant, so Buddhism doesn't say that it's always a miserable experience in the bardo.
In the bardo, apparently, you have some extraordinary powers. You can walk through walls. You move at the speed of thought, almost. And
great love. What about great bliss?
They don't say that a bardo being has anything like that. You know, in the wheel of life, if you have one, they're right there, stuck in the next wheel out from the rooster and the snake and the pig.
When my mother was dying, I got a sense of her. She shared part of it with me, and it was great love. She was slipping away. She was still alive. I don't know.
Oh, I think we talked about in the church that a person who's been very pure in their life can have pure experiences at the end of their life, and that's why to do a death meditation. That's why we're talking about it. You know what I mean? But normally the process of death is very almost always unpleasant, great pain. I mean, at the point that you saw her, she wasn't into that yet. But then beyond that, it's always like that. There's five standard steps you go through, and everyone goes through them, and they're very painful, and they're very disorienting. Yeah, theoretically, you might have some on the other side, but not in practice, you know. Remember? You know, very unlikely, yeah.
You know, I wonder, and I've experienced and known people who actually look forward to death. As you get older, you realize the deterioration that has taken place in the body and the mind. And you want to accept, you want to escape that, you want to, in some cases.
That's a common statement, you know, that if life gets to be past a certain age, such a burden and such a repeated boredom, that it would be a relief to die. But you're assuming that the 5 minutes after you die, you're not in a hell realm or something. You see what I mean? And you can't assume that. The book I chose out of the catalog just before we stopped was a reply by a high lama to a question of, was the Buddha being literal when the Buddha said, your odds of having a nice rebirth are about that much compared to the mass of the planet? You know? And then the question was, is that literal? And they said, yes. So you're making a very grave assumption that things might be better than that 5 minutes after you die.
I don't think you're making an assumption so much as you're accepting. You know, in the prayer, the Christian prayer, thy will be done.
Mm-hmm.
You just simply accept
it. In Buddhism, we don't. We fight it. Like a tiger. You know.
What can you do about it?
Well, that's why we're having this class. Tomorrow afternoon's class. For sure.
I was looking forward to that too until I became a Buddhist and realized I have to do it over and over.
Anyway. Yeah.
You were speaking about just cutting down our income necessities to what we need to maintain our practice and our health.
Yeah.
Would there be cases where people might also want to have resources in order to offer to others beyond just their own needs?
Yeah, I'm not saying that if wealth comes to you easily, you know, that it's not a very valuable thing. And the idea that to be a good Buddhist you have to be poor is a fallacy. You know, it's actually, once your head is together, it's preferable to be very wealthy because you can use it for other people. So I'm not saying that, you know, the only good Buddhist is a poor Buddhist. And the only good Buddhist is a semi-employed Buddhist. I'm not saying that. It's ideal at many spiritual stages, especially at the beginning, to be to have a lot of time to yourself for your practice and not to have too many other things to think about. But once you're strong enough and your practice is good enough, then bodhisattvas are supposed to be busy. You know, you're supposed to have as many projects going on as you can handle. That's Thich Nhat. That's Mahayana. Big capacity. But you have to be careful not to mistake your capacity. You see what I mean? Which will kill you. You see what I mean? So you have to take care of your spiritual life first, and when you do, and as you're able to, then you can add other spiritual responsibilities, and you must. And in the end, it would be very desirable to have a lot of money and a big piece of land, for example, and not out of any desire, but just that you can help more people with that. So, but spiritually, you're capable of saying, I practice till a certain time of day, and nothing changes it, you know, and you have to keep that space. Benjamin Franklin did this thing. He did a very interesting thing. He was amazing. You should read his autobiography. But he wouldn't open his shop till 11 o'clock. It was something like 11 o'clock. And he said, I do my experiments in the morning. I do my private life. I take care of my moral life. You know, I take care of my needs. I do my prayers. He basically is saying, I do my own practice till 11. And let the world adjust to my schedule. You see what I mean? They'll know that Ben Franklin's not in the shop, the printing shop, from 9 to 11. And they'll get used to it. You know, I took every Wednesday off for 16 years in corporate life, vice president of a company. And people got used to it. They didn't call me on Wednesday, you know. And then they would catch me. I'd say, let's finish this deal tomorrow. They'd say, no, Michael, it's Tuesday. You know? You know? Like, you know, I had that trick. That trick didn't work after a while. Okay. Very quickly, here are... three resolutions to make. Okay? So, in the end, we're going to have three spaces going up to the door. Then we're going to go through the door of death is certain. There's going to be a room with three elements in it, which are the three reasons why death is certain. Then we're going to come to another door, which is the time of death is not certain. And there's going to be three things in that room to remind us of that. Then we're going to come to another door that says, when you die, only Dharma can help you, because the only thing you take with you is your karma. And then when we get through that door, there's going to be three things to remind us of that. And then we're going to pass into another room, which is called the three decisions to take once you know you're going to die. You know, once you've done a good meditation on death, there's three decisions to make. Okay? And we won't do the visualization of these three tonight, but I'll list them for you tonight. Okay? Since they're on your homework. Is that the homework? Yeah. Okay. For those of you who can't see, number one is knowing that you have to die, right? Having done the first meditation, the death is certain, decide you must begin your practice now, okay? It's time to begin. I'm sorry. Decide to begin your practice. Because I repeat, it's only those things that you stick into the ineffable, invisible, untouchable mind stream that you can take with you, you see? It's only the good or bad that you stuff in there during your life that goes on, okay? And knowing that you should knowing you're going to die, you should start working on it. Okay. Number two, for those of you who can't see it, is a reaction to the second stage of the meditation, which is that you never know when you're going to die, and that is knowing you could die at any moment. Quit your worldly work immediately, and start practicing today. Okay. Knowing that you could die at any moment. Quit your worldly work today, now, immediately, and start practicing. Again, worldly is a touchy word, okay? Personally, my lama forced me to go to work, okay? My lama demanded that I go to work. I didn't have to go to work. I had enough money. I had inheritance. I wasn't rich, but I had my practice space in my bed. And he said, this is the best thing for your practice, you see what I mean, is to be in a normal office and see normal people's pain and be around normal stuff and don't tell them you're a Buddhist and use it as your laboratory for your Dharma practice. And it was wonderful. There's nothing like it, you know. So I'm not saying worldly doesn't necessarily mean that all work is worldly. You make it worldly or you make it Dharma practice. Depends on you, okay? A 40-hour job can be a great Dharma opportunity. And for me personally, it was the most precious thing I could have done at that time. I resisted him which I never do. And finally, one day I remember he gave this very moving lecture at Rutgers University. I was driving home, and I said, "I'll do anything you want," you know. He said, "Okay, go to work," you know. and it was very wonderful. So I'm not worldly doesn't necessarily mean that you can't work. It just means stop your worldly activities, you know. Stop seeing it as something to for just for money or things like that. Okay. Number three, for those of you who cannot see, is since nothing else can help, comma, concentrate exclusively on spiritual practice. That's the reaction to understanding that you can't take anything else with you except your spiritual practice. Okay. And again, don't confuse external spiritual practice with internal spiritual practice. Okay. You can sit there and memorize all the books in the world. You can pass all the ACI courses with all hundreds. You know, you can be doing all the right sadhanas word for word every morning and not be changing your internal state a bit. You know what I mean? It's possible. I can say. I used to do it. I did Tundruk for 15 years religiously every night at the same place at Perth Amboy on Highway 9. On the way back from work. And I can honestly say I didn't think about it much. You see, I did not. I recited it every night in Tibetan. I can do the long sadhana in Tibetan from memory. And I was able to, I'm being honest, sit through a whole Setu ceremony without thinking about it more than three or four times. And no immediate effect on my inner life. You see what I mean? And actually, then I started keeping the book and it changed. You see what I mean? I started doing Tundruk that way. Instead of just reciting it, you see what I mean? And I like the book because it forces you to examine whether you've really done anything internally relating to Dharma or not. And I think especially for people who are involved in the Dharma business, meaning translating, running centers, printing correspondence courses, stuff like that, it's very easy to confuse that with changes in your inner life. You know what I mean? It's very tempting to, I mean, a lot of the students I have who are involved with the administration of the classes end up not taking the classes or not doing their homework and not doing their quizzes. And somehow they think that because they're involved with running the class that they don't have to do that. But then they're cheating themselves out of the main reason to do that. You see what I mean? So I think especially for people involved in the running of Dharma, it can be very dangerous. You know, it's for a teacher too. For a long time I put in the book, my book, taught an inspiring class tonight. And then it dawned on me one night. That didn't change my inner life at all. You know what I mean? That's not it. Much better to write down that I almost got jealous of this other teacher, but I stopped myself. You know what I mean? That's more important than teaching a three-hour class. That's a more important spiritual event than teaching someone else something. You see what I mean? And that's all. We're talking inner life. Now, to do that, you can do it at work. And you can do it as a housewife or whatever. That's a decision to focus on what you're cramming into your mind stream that you've got to take with you when you die. That's all. So your outward activity may not have to change very much, but you must change the inward activity. It has to be all focused on, am I having a mental affliction right now? You know, can I change something about it? How can an understanding of emptiness affect how I'm feeling right now about this other person? You know, and so actually it becomes a blessing to be going to work, a blessing to be busy mother in a household or something like that, okay? Anything can become Dharma practice. And many things which are externally Dharma practice ain't Dharma practice at all. Okay? Yeah?
I just got a question. You were talking about you were repeating the, whatever you call this, periodically.
Yeah.
I was down in Miami listening to the Dalai Lama, and he used a similar example that for years he was doing X, Y, and Z, and it wasn't until about 15 years later that he really started to begin to understand and really started to put some things into practice. Is that part of the transition when you're going from non-Buddhist that you think that you're doing something when it's not really happening? Or is it, I'm trying to get a perspective.
No, I know what you mean. Let's put it this way. Is it necessary to recite Tundruk for 15 years and not think about it to trigger the years where you are thinking about it? And I think it maybe is. But I think you could shorten the time. Seriously, you know. I think being faithful to the practice for 15 years caused me to really understand what it was about. But I wouldn't want other people to take that long. You know? And I'm being very honest. I'm not like gushing out something that's not true. I'm honest about it. I didn't think about it. And that's a very dangerous thing. Okay. All right. Take a short break. And we'll do a short meditation. We won't do all 9 new elements, but we'll add like 1 room or 2. Okay. All right. So take a break. All right. Okay. We're going to do a brief meditation on some of the last points. Okay. We're going to continue through the, we'll start at the first door, the yellow door. Okay. Ready? So sit up straight. And watch your breath. Rather deep breaths, but not forced. One of the things you can do when you're doing a breath meditation, and it's a little tricky, you have to practice a little bit, but to be aware of your breath going in and out, you can close your throat, okay, and watch, okay. And actually, you're constricting something here, okay, and it's not with your nostrils, okay. It's like down here, and you don't do it to your mouth, but you do it like this. Listen. Can you hear it? Yeah, it's real loud in your own ear. Okay. And make it soft, but it's a good way to regulate your breath. You know, it'll make the breath. You can either, when you drop to a more subtle level, it can be the hairs in your nose, which sound the same when you're at a good level of meditation. But if you don't get there, then do it this way. And you just close the, it takes a little practice. People mistake their, that's not it, okay? That's not it, okay? That's just the boogery nose, okay? But this one is the, And it helps you regulate your breath. It helps you slow the breath down. Because you can, if you're not doing a good breathing, you know, you can feel it. So try it at home, maybe. And not too loud. Not so loud that it bothers someone next to you. But it's very good for breathing meditation. Okay. Now look at the door in front of you, the big oak door, golden yellow color, represents that you must die. You go into the first room and see the huge shoulder height wild dog chained to the wall on the right and think that death cannot be stopped, the karma wearing out cannot be stopped. Then move on to the stand, and on top of the stand is an hourglass, and you look at it and you see the sands running through, and most of the sands are gone already. And it represents that your life is leaking away, even as you sleep, even as you talk to others, even as you sit in a Dharma class. You're getting older and your life is leaking away all the time, at the same rate all the time, never pausing. Now as you pass down the corridor, you're running, and pictures on the wall with little lights above them are passing by quickly, and you have only a few fleeting seconds to recognize one of your teachers or one of the teachings they've given you on a certain date in a certain place, and your life is too busy and moving by too fast to stop and look at them and appreciate them and to learn deeply what they had to teach you. And you're running down this corridor that way, representing the fact that even if you do decide to study or to practice, you don't have much time. You never have enough time. And at the end of the corridor, there's a green door, large, huge green door, rectangular. And that represents the second step of the meditation, meaning the second main division, that the time that you're going to die is not fixed. You don't know when you're going to die. And you look at the door for just a second and think, now I'm entering the meditation on how the time of death is not fixed, not certain. When you come into a room, it's triangular. You're at the... It's an elongated triangle. So you're walking in at the top of the triangle, and then it opens into a larger room. So the top of the triangle is farther away from the other two corners. So you're walking into a room that basically opens out wider as you go. And right in front of you, as you walk in, is a garbage can. And in the garbage can at the bottom, like a big calendar with the number 72 on it in black, and it's in the bottom of the garbage. And that means forget this average lifespan thing, okay? Seriously, okay? You look at it and you say, that's a lie. That whole expectation that it builds in your mind that you will have until 72 years old or something is a very cruel lie of your culture. And There is no average for any single person. There's no reason why you should expect to live any longer than this week or today. It's an unreasonable thought to say I have so many years left until the average. Then as the room widens out, then you're walking to an area, and it's a normal room. It has a furniture all around, chairs, carpet, objects like a TV, books. And you're walking through them towards the other side of the room. And you're aware that there's like a tripwire somewhere, that if you touch it, you'll die. The bomb will go off, the place will explode, you'll die. And one of these objects around you, you're looking at the look at the objects one by one, like the blanket on the bed, that might catch fire one night and burn you. People say you, and you know, in your mind, you're thinking that's not going to happen to me. I have a student whose mother was sitting on a couch, and normal person, and the cord was behind it, and the cord frayed, and the couch went up, and the house exploded within a few minutes. I mean, just everything. Made of plastics, and a blanket could very easily kill you. A chair could kill you. Look at the chair. Think, would that kill me? Is the bomb there? You know, how many people died slipping off a chair? And look at each object like that, and think that they could kill you. Food on the table, and that something in there could kill you. And walk through the room, realizing that all the things that you need to keep you alive. One of them will probably kill you. And as you're walking towards there's a door at the base of the triangle in the middle, and as you get down to it, you start to approach the door, and you step on a thorn, and you lean down and you take it out of your foot, and there's a little tiny spot of blood that comes out, and look at it and think, I was thinking about, I read about Theodore Roosevelt's son, he got a thorn in his foot, a tiny thorn like that, and it got a little bit infected, and then it got worse and worse. And this happened in our monastery also to a boy, a young boy in the fields, and he died from that. I saw him die from that, and it also happened to Theodore Roosevelt's son. And just look at it and think how fragile your body is, how little it takes to kill it. And that's the meditation on how fragile your body is, how many little things can kill your body. Think about little things that can kill your body. A little virus picked up from someone else called HIV, a little break in the chromosome of a single cell in your body, which kills you of cancer. Think about it. And then you look up and there's a red door leading into another room, and you look at it for a moment and reflect. This is the third of the main meditations, and I'm going to meditate about how when I die, it's only my spiritual life can help me. Then you open the door and you enter it's sort of like a greenhouse, and there's an arched corridor of glass that goes down the whole length of the room. It's like a rectangle. And you can see on the other side there are things outside the glass. So it's like a little tunnel or something, and you can stand up in it. It's pretty tall, and the room is well lit. It's like a greenhouse, and there's sunlight coming in from the outside. So you can clearly see the things outside of the little glass walls of the art of the hallway you're walking down. And then there's more glass on the outside walls. And then in between the two, you can see certain things. And the first thing you see on both sides walking down the hallway is our friends that you have, people that you love. And put there the three or four people who are closest to you. And they're talking to each other, and they're laughing and having conversation, and they cannot see you. And you're like knocking on the glass and trying to get their attention and banging on the glass, and they can't even see you, and it makes you frustrated. They can't hear you. They don't pay you any attention. It's like you're invisible. It's like they don't hear you. And this represents the bardo and the fact that you can't take those people with you. The moment after you die, you will be alone. You may perhaps even be able to see them, and they won't be able to interact with you at all. They won't be able to reach you or contact you, and reflect on that. And then as you move down halfway down this rectangular hall, the room, and you're still in this hallway, you could look at each side of the glass, and you can see all the objects that are dear to you. And for me, it's, of course, my laptop and maybe a car that I use, and then some kinds of furniture in my bedroom, and the blankets and the sheets that I use, and some of my old work suits. And I think especially for me, photographs on the ground, scattered, you know, of things I used to like, photographs I used to enjoy, of people I loved, and then my books strewn about the room. And you're walking down the hallway, and the glass is between you and them. You cannot reach them. And you, this represents the fact that you can't take any of them with you. They will be left behind, and it will be frustrating for you. It'll be, at that moment, you'll be quite upset and off balance and almost angry that you can't reach them anymore. And then down towards the end of the room, off to the right side, a dead body, naked, your body. And when you look at the face, it's face up on its back, and you look at the face, and the face is just no features on it. It's just like still the contours of a nose and an eye and a mouth, but unrecognizable, like no clear features, just the pits where the eyes were and a bump where the nose was and a hole where the mouth was, but you can't recognize it. And this is the stage in the meditation where you realize that you have to leave it behind, even your own body and your name and your identity. And no one will remember you shortly after you die. Even the people who are really sensitive and compassionate and attached to you will slowly forget you after you die. And then bring your mind back to the Lama in the chamber of your heart, behind your heart, and thank them for their blessing, and just be with them for a short time. And then dedicate it to other people. Think about the good karma we did today. Nobody talks about death like this. I doubt that anyone in the United States has, or this kind of a group of people has talked about these things today. And rejoice and send out the energy to other people. Good karma. Light from the pores of your body. Imagine people, just normal people around Raleigh. You know, one of them gets hit here and there, and very happy, something happy comes into their mind. Okay, relax. We're going to go through it one more time. Okay? Very first thing, what? On the outside. I mean, let's start from the preliminaries. Yeah, really, it's all the way up to the tables, okay? The dangers of not having death meditation, right? All the way up to the table. And trying to get to the food and hurting other people because you're bumping them, okay? Being miserable, not really going for what you want to go for, you know. And then the bridge. Oh, divesting. I mean, the benefits of thinking about your death. Okay, dumping stuff. All right, unnecessary activities, relationships, and objects. Okay. Next one has two parts. Yeah, the right way to meditate on death and the wrong way to meditate. Sorry, wrong and then right. Right. So the wrong way is to get like some kind of paralyzed by thinking about how hard it's going to be. And then the right way is like floating across that meadow, you know, like, and really, if you get good at this meditation, it's a big gift I'm offering you. If you take it, you know, you'll be really, your life will be really straightened out. You know, your priorities are in order and you just naturally get happier. Okay. Immensely happy. And every day is like a continual Christmas. Okay. Christmas morning, every single day. Okay. Seriously. Okay. It's that, it feels like that. Okay. First door. Meaning? Must die. Okay. Walk in, first thing on your right.
Big dog.
Big dog. We have this friend, Dr. Taylor in Washington. He's like, every single dog he sees, good dog, good dog. Yeah, I said, Dr. Taylor, you realize you say that about every single dog you meet? He says, if they don't bite me, they're a good dog. Okay, next thing.
Hourglass.
Yeah, hourglass, okay. Even as we talk, we lost an hour, okay? And the body's getting weaker. I don't care what they tell you in exercise class. You are weaker than tonight than you were this morning. Unless you're keeping your vows well and doing good tantric practice, something like that. Okay, third one. Yeah, hall with pictures moving by too fast, okay? Meaning, even when you're in the mood, you don't really have time to practice. Even when things are going well, which is just about never, even when you have a day when no one calls you on the phone and interrupts you, you know, you don't feel bad, you know, your back's not hurting, still life is moving too fast, okay? Next door, green, representing time of death is uncertain. Shape of the room. Yeah, you come in at the top of the triangle. It's sort of like a lengthy triangle, right? Elongated triangle. And you come in here. The first thing you see? Trash can with a 72, okay? It's the big lie. And we really think that way. You really, everyone I ever met and myself says, it thinks in terms of average lifespan. You know, I got 30 years left. I got 25 years left, okay? Second thing. Oh, by the way, meaning that there's absolutely no certainty you're going to live beyond tonight, okay? There is no average for a single case, you see what I mean? Second thing, yeah, all those booby trap things, okay? You know, you're walking through the room and it's like, which one of you is going to kill me, you know? I was thinking to put a ham sandwich vegetarian ham sandwich there somewhere, meaning, you know, that's the one thing that can keep you alive, you know? Remember there's two parts, many things can kill you, a few things can keep you alive. I mean, maybe one smoothie. in the room, seriously, because you got to remember each point of the alarm room, you know what I mean? And this is a very easy way, you know, I've been trying to do it for years, and this is a very easy way. And then you're just walking through and you're looking at each object and saying, which one of you is going to kill me? You know, I would put your car there, you know, and which one is it going to be? Okay. Next thing in that room? Yeah, just a simple thorn, tiny little thorn. I see a stone floor. This is a kind of a weird room, like a dungeon room or something, and there's a stone. And a little tiny, in Arizona where I grew up, we called them stickers. And there's these little things, they're about this big, and they're very hard and sticky, and you see a little piece of blood, little drop of blood come out. And that just represents that the tiniest thing can kill you. Your body is just very fragile. Okay. 4 minutes without this thing going through here. Out these two tiny holes, quarter inch, half an inch. You know, it's amazing. Okay, it's in the mom room, they say it's a miracle. If you think about it, it's just flat miraculous that you're still alive. Okay, that you fed this bag, you know, 2-3 times a day for thousands of thousands of days in a row. It's amazing. Okay, been able to feed it. You know, it's a big success story actually. Okay, next thing. Red door. Red door meaning nothing can help you when you die except Dharma. And then we're going to eliminate all the things that you thought could help you. You go down what kind of a corner? It's like a glass corner like that going down. And then greenhouse kind of glass house. Between the hallway and the outside glass, there's people standing there, which are? Your friends and relatives. I mean, actually see them. Make it specific, you know. And then think of them one by one and say, I can't take you with me. And I will forget you after a few weeks, you know. How much of them do you remember in a dream? Because that's how much you'll remember after you die. And that dream will keep going, and it'll get worse. It'll fade faster and faster as you go on. So you're just looking at them and thinking, they can't help me, you know. Does it mean you should like divorce your wife immediately and stuff like that? No. But it means just don't put your hopes in that, you know. You get your wife and yourself to practice more. That's all.